said before.
We're the number one.
I just have to apologize because the pizza you ordered is all gone.
They are the smarter ones.
So, now maybe each group could talk about, you know, for a few minutes what you we each discussed. Is somebody willing to do that from our group?
Absolutely.
I mean, it was like, oh, cool.
Well, I would just say, like, the one of the best points made, and I think this is the first point made, is that we need to get past the idea that there is a true objective stance, or a true objectivism at all, and that everything is subjective to some extent.
Now, is that just your biased opinion, or is that something?
That's the objective truth.
I was really struck by your story about presenting it at Ivy League school. When you can't argue, you know, morality or you know what's right or wrong, this guy just appealed to what brute power, kind of like.
Right.
Can you just tell that story?
Sure. We were talking about spending a lot of time setting up arguments and finding, being clear about your bias and so on. And I belong to a group of women in Rochester called Rochester Women Against Violence Against Women. We did a whole lot of radical street stuff that was an awful lot of fun, but we also had a fabulous slideshow that had been one of our members. PhD thesis, maybe master's.
You need to revise that, by the way.
Yeah, I know, it was fabulous. So what she had done, and each of us contributed to it, was juxtapose images of women that women have, from women's magazines, women's articles, and that sort of thing, with pornography and how women are treated there, to overlay the way that they reinforce one another. So we did this really excellent presentation at Yale Law School. And at the end of the presentation, one of the students there stood up and he said, "We have inherited the earth. The people in this room are going to be the people we are stepping into power. And we don't have to listen to a bit of this. It doesn't matter what you say, whether it's true, whether it's a lie. We don't care. We have the power. You will do what we say," right? Out loud, just said it, and all the guys in the room applauded. So it was that powerful, the difference between our efforts to struggle to find truth and the dismissal of it by people.
You can just say it's too bad it didn't happen in the more modern era where you can film it and put it on YouTube.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
You know, the Global Village really has people that
and behaving a bit better, at least on this.
I was also struck by this sort of discussion about we had what the history that we're taught in school presents really just sort of like this mythological positive. You know, this basically leaves out a lot of mostly negative, all the negative stuff about American history. And how dangerous and disillusioning that is when you actually start finding out reality, you know, when you, and I mean, you described that well, that like there's just like a whole bunch of people you know that are your age that are just like struggling with this. Like, for a little while, you just don't believe anything then. And just sort of this.
Sort of go play World of Warcraft for a couple of years.
Yeah, like you can become completely cynical, hopefully become revolutionary eventually, but then there's this. Like, yeah, this disconnect that happens between reality and what you've been told. Was there anything else on group one then?
Oh, just... just
I thought you were group two.
No, we were number one.
We were one.
We were one and you had the pizza.
And we'll never forget it.
Anyway, we were talking about like authenticity and a little bit of legitimacy, right? You're a news source. You know, there's a sort of active disinformation campaigns go on and lying, and then there's sort of the omission that Zinn was talking about. And one way that sort of Zinn talked about was like, you know, he has his values, but he also is open to facts and changing and giving an assessment. but he also is honest in putting out where he's coming from, putting out his slant. And I think that there was some agreement in the room. I don't think there was any really disagreement in the room, which is nice. But, or not. Maybe that would have been a more interesting conversation. Anyways,
it's pretty interesting.
Basically, the idea that, you know, if you can, if you know your prejudices, know your biases, can put them out there in a compelling, you know, let the readership know, and then they're able to write the story from your perspective with your information, then that's probably a little more honest than pretending that you're unbiased or fair and balanced, whatever, you know, normative statement, objective you want to use.
Right, because there is no such thing as unbiased.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, I think that it's not to say that you're biased, and then not say how you're biased. That's dishonest. That you can at least then come out and say, here is my bias, this is my slant.
Yes.
And as long as you combine that transparency along with some rigor and accuracy in your reporting, you do something that is ideally to sort of mythical, highly educated American, they will be able to see it as being perhaps more trustworthy if it's biased than other reports.
Unfortunately, now there's a whole lot of people that just self-select, even if you do them the courtesy of telling them, look, I'm a leftist, I'm going to try and be fair and balanced, but I'm a leftist, so keep that in mind. If you do that, they'll turn it off immediately. They won't ever listen to you.
Vice versa. And you tell me that you're a right-wing teabag, I'm not going to listen to you either. So
my whole family calls me before holidays and says, now, Susan, you behave.
We don't
my family
that
does
to
that too,
Susan.
Actually.
Did you know that was a waste of breath?
Well, I mean, somebody made an interesting point. When you get into an argument like that with somebody on Facebook, you know, just is using this as one cultural example, you're not doing it to win over the person that you're completely loggerheading with.
Yeah.
You're doing it to inform everyone around you who's watching that,
right?
Because then they're going to see this discussion and be like, oh, yeah, that's interesting. I never thought about that way. So I don't think the idea is to sway people that are so ideologically opposed to you as much as it is to sway the people that don't know where they fall. And that's the real interesting part. Like,
yeah.
How can you convince or persuade or show that, you know, there's more value for this thing than... we're getting off topic, though. I didn't know what the other group discussed.
Yeah, why don't we move to what the discussion was at here. Group number two, I believe.
Maybe you top that.
Group equal.
Oh, we just talked about you guys.
Number one percenters. Really? That's how you talked about
it? So you were fascinated.
Well, Jeff, you want to start doing street actions with Rob O'Run, who's running the best anti-nuclear march that ever took place, or demonstration. He had a group called Mutants for Nukes, and everybody came with extra limbs and extra eyes.
Yes.
It was the best demo.
Right.
That was great. Yes,
yeah, cancer is growth, and growth is the American way.
Death and stand in front of like a recruiting office and just like shake people's hands.
That'd be really
good. You're just making my shot really.
I love it.
Hooray.
Yeah. Big fight.
Yeah.
No favors.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to kind of mess with stuff like that, like kind of just distort what they're doing in like a funny or satirical way. Like.
Yes, sir.
Did that recently at Planned Parenthood too, on Tuesdays and Thursdays when the real, you know, far right pro-life types are out there. I made a sign that said hooray for overpopulation and hung out with them for a little while. So you can like get away with it there if you're just like kind of...
I think the Daily Show and the Onion are showing humor is one of the best ways.
Yes,
I think it fosters people being more intelligent too, to be honest with you.
I think the same side of that coin, though, humor allows people to detach and say, like, laugh at stuff and say, oh, I'm against that, but yet continue to participate in the system without any real action.
True,
so
yeah, it's kind of arch irony.
You need to be wary when you watch The Daily Show and stuff. I mean, like, I support the message, but it allows people to sort of be like, yeah, fuck the man, and then change the channel to something.
The danger is it's all just turning into entertainment.
There
yeah,
right.
It's all humorous.
It's great catharsis and everything, but like, yeah.
Well, like you mentioned the thing of like mutants for nuclear power, like things like that. Like humor acts as like I don't know if anyone knows the situation. It's like a detournement. You can go in there with these very serious sort of things, and anyone who opposes your view is just not, that's not going to work, or something like that, will sometimes,
it's
just so kind of absurd
that
it'll get around all that, and it just kind of jolts people.
Yeah.
It's
not
how you use it.
Get back into it.
And also,
so I was just going to suggest, just because we have 15 minutes, well, actually like 10, because Ben's going to talk about what's going on next week. That maybe, and we're back in the group, that I'll start taking staff again. That's cool. That just means when we're having the discussion. And I was wondering if anyone was there sort of something you guys came. I mean, not that there was anything to come up with, but like, I don't know, just interesting.
Did you solve any little problems?
No, I don't know. We talked a lot of different stuff, but I think one thing that was kind of focused on was the trivialization of stuff of news in the news media. And entertainment in general, and sort of the way of like one way of being objective is just telling things that are very uncontroversial, which is, in other words, saying unimportant or just, you know, whatever, and just like thinking about all the different TV shows and things like that are on the air now that are like just sort of just very, I don't know, I mean, we talked about, what did I learn about? Yeah, who is...
Boo-boo.
Yeah, boo-boo, or
I don't know.
We learned it on a couple of shows.
Oh, you guys didn't know.
Teen Moms and other things like that.
I see a little bit.
I shared a story with the other number twos. That's right, about the experience I had in Western Massachusetts about historical ignorance. I won't repeat it here because it's probably boring. But I have another example, because I have a substitute taught for a couple of days at the School Without Walls years ago, and they were covering the Vietnam War, and I looked over the textbook, and it's like, I had this urge to throw out the window, because it mentioned, touched all the headline events, but it did not go even one step back into the history and show how the U.S. canceled elections in Vietnam in 1956, which was supposed to create a unified Vietnam. And the reason that Eisenhower gave was because the other side would have won. I mean, yeah. And that comes up again in regards to the Arab Spring and how dedicated are we really to democracy if people in those newly free countries decide to elect governments that we don't like. Which comes first, our interests or democracy?
I also was talking, I brought up the last part, but I talked about it a little bit more, was how, like, I remember, yes, I'm older, but how they, at the beginning of the Vietnam, they didn't really show the bodies, but when they started showing actual war, how the people's sentiment changed and how they really were against the war and how that part of history, as far as the media was concerned, the government definitely learned from, because they've really made it so that that stuff is not shown anymore, because they know how it can affect and make people against that, and how with the rec war, how they really sold, instead of the media being the watchdog and, you know, a separate arm of, you know, to kind of watch government and keep it honest, they were part of the propaganda machine that sold the war to the people.
Embedded.
And embedded in journalists. And how, you know, so people forget history, but the government definitely learned from that and made sure that that didn't happen again. That's why we can have wars for 10, 12, 15 years and not think about it.
Yeah, there's a guy, I'm looking at his last name, it's like, or how it's last name pronounced, his name's Cenk Uygur or something like that. He's on MSNBC for a long time. He does the Young Turk show now. He has a story about, I'm not going to retell it well, but basically he was in a situation where his boss was telling him that he didn't have enough, he had too many liberals on the show. He didn't have enough Republicans, or like he wasn't honoring, he wasn't doing, showing both sides enough or something like that, and he didn't feel that way. And then in, when he responded in opposition to it, his boss said, we are the establishment. And this is like the guy that's running MSNBC. He'd say, we are the establishment. So I just thought that was an interesting tidbit to realize that they're not two separate entities anymore, even if they pretend to be. It's just like, just as if you have different parts of government that work together, but they don't know how they're working together because the person on top of it actually knows. It's all the same thing in my mind now at this point with the big meeting hours.
I was just, what, right at the tail end, we started talking about fallacies, and I don't know the names of them, but one of, you could probably help me out here, like one of the things is like a false dichotomy, you know, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
And this reminds me of, you know, the whole party, the two-party system, that we're given this sort of like two choices of, you know, like, this very narrow corporate agenda. And one, yeah, I mean, one might be like slightly more progressive on social issues and one might be like slightly more fascistic, but they're really both advancing the same interests. And yet there is this very real dichotomy in our history, which is like the class war. And this is just like completely ignored. You know, like, yeah, it's just like washed over for this just like unity, this fake unity. And then somehow like, this understanding we have that there is divides in our society is channeled into this false dichotomy. But then you can choose between this sort of safe thing, and then there's like the loyal opposition. And
it's so fueled through all the media networks. Like, what do you, I mean,
yeah.
If you're watching like Rachel Maddow, she's still, you know, what she's doing is she's amping you up against the Republicans the whole time. Like, I mean, she does a lot of good reporting. I really believe that. As far as reporting goes, it's on television. She's still, her goal is to do the us and them thing, the Republicans versus the Democrats, just like any of the other mainstream networks, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Are we just going to pre-flop here?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. And maybe we'll
sort
of wrap. No, we're all good. How about a couple more minutes, and then we'll wrap up, and you can talk about this next week.
Okay. I mean, it always makes you think about, like, when you're reading an article, like, who the pronouns refer to, you know? Like, if it says we, okay, who is we? Or if it says, like, you know, the history of us, well, whose history was that? Because, you know, there's a lot of different histories in the world, right? And it's usually, you know, white men's history or whatever. I don't know. I think that's one easy way that you could kind of pretend, you could sort of seem to be objective, I guess, is when people don't realize that, you know, that the... You're talking about a specific group of people and you're acting like it's universal, and the reason it kind of feels like that is because they're the people who have written the history so far. It's kind of, yeah, that's interesting interplay of both history and media, I think.
And doing that gives you a false sense of inclusion, too.
Mm.
I mean,
yeah.
you can go along with things a long way if somebody's saying, well, you know how we feel.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't know where I heard it, but somebody was talking about always be suspicious when management starts talking about the company as a family.
Right.
You know, we're one big family.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean?
A long canvassing, one of the lines in the script is, all your neighbors are signing on with us.
Yeah.
So, any last burning thoughts about this before we move on? Ben's going to talk about the articles for next week in a minute, but before we do that, is there any last comments on this?
I have sort of a question, I guess, or concern, I don't know. Just thinking about the ways our schools are sort of set up so that we don't necessarily, or I guess I could speak for my own, how I was fed through the education system kind of thing, like, critical thinking is absolutely not encouraged, or it wasn't for me until college, and even then it's sort of questionable. So as far as like presenting, we talked about, you know, if you're making a video, it has to be cut down to 3 minutes because people won't pay attention to it after that, or like things on the news being just like flash, 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 information, 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 like how do we deal with creating sort of as unbiased or openly biased, I guess, presentation of history in schools if people don't want their views challenged, or if like there's not enough time in the day to teach history, just history alone, if you're giving you know, context of like, this is some people's history, this is how it affected us, or this is in the context of us, this is in the context of the world or the place that it actually happened in, and I don't know, there's just so much that goes into telling history. How do we change that? Like, how is that even possible to teach?
Well, and then when they try, like what's happened now is they're getting rid of, you know, Latino studies, and they're getting rid of African American studies and gender studies because, you know, those are biased and those are, you know, divisive. And it's like, you know, it's just...
I mean, didn't we, our group brought up the thing of, if you do a reading good article, though, who is there going to be to read it and understand that it's, you know, honestly biased information and accurately reported and in-depth and well-researched and rigorous and so forth. It's not going to matter if people are, you know, not to be crass, but stupid.
Well, he's from Harvard. It's got to be good. Yeah, so, I mean, it makes it more complicated, but those are the most interesting stories, too, I feel like. I feel like sometimes this sort of attention span is in response to just information overload, but also just trivia overload, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and I feel like study of, you know, the actual study of abolition and anti-slavery and civil rights and the workers' movement, like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's my bias. It's personally what I like, but it's really interesting, and I think if you compare it to what, you know, qualifies as history, it's way more interesting. So maybe that's one way, you know, I think it is. And I think like a lot of indie media stories are actually, the sort of story of it is a lot more interesting than the corporate media stories. On the other hand, and that's actually another week that I'm going to be helping with, that it talks about like the way that it's presented in a lot of ways. Like a lot of these like corporate stories are about just like some new product coming out, but it's a very interesting story. Like it's a good story. And a lot of the stories that we're telling is about something that's like life and death, critical importance, but it's not. Told the best, so I don't know. I guess in a way it is dumbing down, but it's sometimes it's also just like, yeah, how you tell a good story.
Simplify. Yeah. Even if it's good, though, the dominant media will find some way to suppress it. I mean, why aren't there any schools named after John Brown, for example? Mm-hmm.
It has to be like a consumable.
Yeah. Celebrate Columbus Day.
Like I can take this like two sentence meme and repeat it at the dinner table or later in school and seem like I know something about something. It has to be something that I can attach to myself that's going to make me feel like I'm more legitimate afterwards. That's what they're doing. They're searching for that rather than searching for something that's actually going to inform you about what's going on around you.
Well, maybe that's like what we like in the beginning of the zine. There's a quote by, you know, Subcomandant Marcos, and he talks about the third way. He says, you can just, like, disbelieve all media. Mm-hmm. That's one way. You can, you know, disregard media, so just don't even watch them. Mm-hmm. But he talks about a third way of building our own media. That's our conference, or our reading series, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like if there are, like, students that maybe you know, or anybody here knows, that aren't getting another side, bring them here. If there are people that don't know, you know, or want to have an in-depth conversation about something, like, bring to the squirrel, show them Indie Media. I know Catherine has showed people articles from Indie Media, not, you know, the whole site necessarily, because there's some really crazy crap on that site sometimes. And spam, you know, we get lots of spam. We're not endorsing those things.
And hopefully there'll be a radio project soon.
Who knows? Yeah, but just like, you know, the idea that like we need to build that, like we don't have to count on the mass media for our media services.
Absolutely.
It's great when they get something out, because then suddenly you have like 30,000 people go to our website and you're like, whoa, let's overload. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, if you can get, you know, like even the amount of people in this room tonight, it's great. Like, it's so exciting to see people interested and want to talk about these issues that normally they're not supposed to talk about. Are not supposed to think about unless you're thinking about it.
Or there's not even a venue to talk about.
Right, there's not even
individual conversations over coffee.
Right. Or Facebook or something. Yeah.
Or just surface value.
I just want to point out that it's 9, and I did promise we'd end by 9, so Ben's going to give a really a 1 minute thing about it.
Yeah,
to get more.
50 seconds. So this is every week. Next week, it's the next couple articles in the book. It's about free culture. First, I guess maybe that versus permissions culture or copyright culture, and sort of talks about, I guess, basically, first of all, how copyright, trademark, patent law in the US, and now it's basically a global thing, a lot of times limits what you could do with culture, meaning like the media that's been produced, the words, the images, and stuff like that. And it's, I guess it's really important if you're doing news, because it's always a question of, can I use that picture, you know, can I use that sample, what if I modify it? So there's like some sort of like legal questions that might not be the most interesting, but I guess are important. But I think the interesting and also important thing is sort of how there's a movement growing to try to get rid of all that. So first of all, put all the work that we create into open licenses that says, you know, if you like my stuff, you can share it with somebody else, it's fine. You can take it and modify it, and that's cool. And so that's like the above ground kind of work, and then I guess the underground work is also really people who are just kind of fed up with copyright and are just taking, you know, what they want, remixing it together and putting out what they want to do. So there's a couple articles about just, you know, what is the free culture movement, and then there's this website link that you could go to, which is about the Gray album, which is kind of an interesting thing. The guy mixed together the Black album by
Jay-Z.
I'm trying to think who made which album. And the White Album by the Beatles came up with a new, really good album that was like very highly, people liked it a lot, and totally illegal, right? So what kind of happened with that? So anyways, yeah, that's what we have to answer.
Chip food out of Paul McCartney's mouth.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Sir Paul McCartney.
So people are welcome to hang out, but this is sort of the end of the official part. And this was really great. Thanks everyone.
I have a question.
Sign-in-sheet?
One of the things that I found with Facebook is it's wonderful with sharing articles. And then I wonder if people are, you know, like I read a more diverse, I'm more diverse in what I'm reading because I'm seeing different things, and I'm like, wow, that sounds really interesting, or that.
On your news feed or whatever?
Mm-hmm. I don't put out personal stuff more. It's more just, you know, if I see something interesting, I'll put it out. But I was wondering if other people have found
it. No, that's my, besides keeping in touch with, especially my generation, everyone moves around.
Yeah.
Like everyone I know. But I have, you know, a couple friends who post lots of science articles. I don't have the time to go through and find and see things about stuff on culture and so forth. I have a friend who studied linguistics, and he'll post stuff on that. And this is stuff that on your own is hard to, you can't go through that. One reaches out to you, and they put it in there. Yeah, so every day it's been more. Ideally, like I'm sad when one day I might do that, they're wrong.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing. You know, for a point cartoon,